Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. This is episode 126, Transportation and the Shape of Cities. I'm Dan Safarik. Greg is off this week, and my guests are the authors of the book Transportation and the Shape of Cities, Christoph Spieler, David Copeland Laredo, and Mandy Chapa. Welcome aboard, everybody. Why don't you introduce yourselves, since it would be very long-winded and probably incorrect if I were to try to do so. We'll start with Christoph.
Yeah, Christoph Spieler. I am a planner and an engineer. Spent most of my career as a consultant working with David and Mandy, doing projects all across the United States. Also served as a Houston Metro board member, taught at Rice University, and wrote the book Trains, Buses, People, an Opinionated Atlas of U.S. and Canadian Transit. And I now work for the city of Madison, Wisconsin as the director of transportation.
Hi, everyone. Mandy Chapa, a planner with a background in architecture. I have been in Houston all my life. I am currently with Lionheart Places working with David. And I also teach, I taught with Christoph for many, many years, and I continue to teach urban transportation at Rice.
Yeah, and I'm David Copeland-Laredo. I am also an architect turned urban planner. I also work at Lionheart Places, and I've worked with Mandy and Christoph 9 years, and we lost Christoph last year to Madison, Wisconsin. We were together in Houston for a long time together, but yeah, I'm excited.
Well, thank you all for coming. Transportation in the Shape of Cities, it's kind of a... kind of like an instruction manual that's in the form of a narrative, if that's a fair way to put it. I find the book to be, I use the word pedantic in the best possible sense, in that it really does seem like it's intended for classroom instruction, as it walks you through the, let's say, deceptively simple assumptions that you have to make when you're performing urban planning, especially when taking the extremely wide gradients and ranges of the North American transportation system into city planning. And there's probably no place where the gradients and turn radii are wider than in Houston. So let's talk a little bit about how the origins of this book came together and its roots in Houston, which for those who are not familiar, is rather famous for not having zoning. It does have planning, however.
Yeah. So 11 years ago, Christoph and I put a proposal to teach urban transportation for mostly engineers at Rice University. And a lot of that class material became this book. We never thought it would, but over the years, we kept a lot of the material we put together from class number one, still use that material. And along the way, throughout the years, we got David Copeland, who was the best designer I've ever worked with, to help us with the graphics, and they became handouts. And I think as we worked through all of this, we found an opportunity to turn this into a book. So I'll let others weigh in a little bit, but that's exactly right. This really did come out of a teaching course.
Yeah, and it also came out of our work, in that in doing planning and working with cities and neighborhoods and transit agencies and everybody else, you really start to see transportation as a kind of puzzle you need to solve, that there's a set of pieces you are trying to move around and fit in, and sometimes you're trying to fit them into budget, but more than that, you're trying to fit them into space, and realizing that there's a set of inherent constraints, so that we have to talk to a community about what is it you want to accomplish with this street, with this network, with this place. But then you also have to confront the inherent geometry of trying to make that happen within the space that you have. And that's really what this book is about.
Yeah, these are obviously literally huge considerations that so dominate the landscapes of particularly North American cities. I feel like a subtitle for this thing would be like, trains are huge, trucks are huge. You don't get it. They're really huge. And like compare this to the amount of space. I just love that it starts with, you know, just a human walking down the street, you know, and how much space that takes up. And then, you know, it kind of implodes some of the assumptions that we have because, you know, a wheelchair, we think of, oh my gosh, you have to make all this extra space for a wheelchair, but it's actually only a couple inches wider than a human walking down the street. It's just when you have to consider backing into things that only have one entrance and then backing out that it starts to become a big consideration. And likewise, you know, you think of the cab of a tractor trailer as being a certain size, you know, bigger than a car, but not that much. But then when you think about the trailer and the swing of that trailer behind it, and then you're starting to talk about orders of magnitude greater consideration for intersection design and things like that. So, you know, when you were putting this book together, what was the sort of biggest discovery that surprised you, you know, or that imploded maybe some of your own assumptions, if the objective of the book is to implode the assumptions of your students?
I mean, one of the things I will say that repeatedly comes up is actually just how much space cars take, that whether you are looking at a parking lot or whether you are looking at an intersection, whether you're looking at a street cross section, you realize cars are, I mean, extraordinary in a lot of ways. They like are a mode of transportation that can get us to so many places so conveniently in a way other things can't. But the trade-off for that is a tremendous use of space. And when you try to fit that into a city, especially a pre-existing city, you really quickly run into those constraints. And it's even simple things like sketching out an intersection and then, like you said, trying to make an 18-wheeler turn in that intersection. That gets really hard really quickly.
One of the things that I remember from architecture school that was kind of a rude awakening once I got into an architecture firm that mainly worked in planned communities in, you know, areas like Arizona and California, you know, new suburban developments by big companies like Lennar Homes and stuff like that, was the requirement for a fire truck to fit on a suburban street. And that is one of the things, now maybe I missed it, I don't know if that was in here, but that is one of the biggest governing considerations, right? Is does the fire department have enough room to turn around? And basically, I don't know if this is true in every jurisdiction, but in most of the ones that I've seen, what the fire chief says goes, because you're not getting approval unless the fire department is okay with it. That could go to extend to a building or a platted, you know, street width. How do you deal with that situation?
Yeah, I was going to add, we do have in our book other standards and manuals to reference, and it is hard as we are working through projects here in Houston. I think in Texas, I feel like it might even be harder. But it's really this question around when you're take on a project and the question is around how many lanes of traffic do you leave? It's really hard to get down further than two, because at that point you start to, well, where would the fire truck stop? You know, and how, and so we talk through ideas. We talk through, you know, well, it just takes up the space on the street or it runs over the curb. You know, this is not something that they'll have to do daily, hopefully, but if it's needed, there will be space there that they can go over. But that's exactly right. I think in the United States, more than anywhere else, we have such rigid and tough standards to go by. And this really does shape all of that space that the vehicle, that the automobile takes.
I mean, I think one way to think about it is we're always designing cities for the biggest and the fastest vehicles that need to move through them. And that means the design of vehicles inevitably shapes the design of cities. Like we're even seeing it as traffic moves to more SUVs and fewer sedans. That is actually shaping the way roadways move. It's shaping pedestrian visibility. It's shaping the size of parking spaces. And often, you know, in a residential neighborhood, the fire truck is one of the biggest vehicles that will ever be there. And thus it ends up being the driver of a lot of things. And you have this situation where you're having to design a street for something that, like Mandy said, happens only very rarely. But when it happens, it has to work. And then the question starts being, why is the vehicle that size? And you realize that there's a whole set of national decisions being made about how big things are that end up driving every single place in the United States.
And I know you've largely worked in, you know, in a city where, in a state where things are famously big and famously platted for vehicles. And you talk several of the you know, on-ramp, off-ramp arrangements that you note here are, they're not exclusive to Texas, but they are really celebrated in Texas. They are done bigly, shall we say. You know, the side feeder road that's almost as wide as the entire interstate, you know, it's like doubles the width of the interstate, which is already several hundred feet wide, just absolutely plowing through the landscape. I don't know, Christoph, is that what drove you to Madison, like in hopes of finding... You know, that just seems so tough to work with if you're trying to plan, you know, livable communities, you know, anywhere near that kind of activity.
And I would say that even goes as far as the parking spaces. I mean, parking really drives a lot of the form. You spoke of architecture, and it really does drive the form. And in Texas, we want our spaces to be as wide as we can get them. But you go to, you know, tighter cities, more dense cities, and you can see spaces down to 8 feet, 8.5 feet. But in Texas, we like them to be 9. And so it's like it's across the board, I think, when it comes to designing around the cars. And that ultimately shapes cities. And that's why we've got the Houston that we have.
Yeah. So, I mean, I will say, I mean, Madison is a very different place than Houston. And part of that is decisions like Madison didn't follow through on his freeway plan. And so we have no freeways anywhere near downtown Madison. And that completely changes the character of the city. And so, you know, we talk in the book about how lasting these transportation decisions are. And you can see the decisions that were made in Houston, the decision that were made in Madison, the decision that were made in New York are different decisions. And obviously, we also talk about simply the age of cities. That's not a Houston-Madison difference, but it is a difference to, say, New York City. But I also think the book really makes the point of how universal a lot of this is. That, you know, ultimately, designing a street in Madison, designing a street in Houston is grappling with the same basic geometry that no amount of neighborhood character or different aspirations can overcome. This is how much space a bike lane takes, and it takes the same space whether you're in Houston or whether you're in Madison. Like, how long is a bus? Same bus length. And there really is this really very common thing that shapes all of our cities. And one of the things I like to say is that, you know, the Ashto Green book is probably one of the most important documents in American life. Because it literally shapes the world that we move through every day and shapes the environment that we live in every day.
For those who are unaware, what is the Ashto Green book?
Ashto is basically the Association of State Highway Departments, and the Green Book is the design manual that they put out, which is kind of at its heart a manual for designing highways, but it is also a manual for designing streets. And it tells you things like how tight is a curve allowed to be, how steep is a street allowed to be, how much visibility do you need as you go around a corner, what kind of vehicles do you need to design for, what kind of turn, how does an intersection need to accommodate turning movements, and has a some looseness, but also a bunch of really rigid standards of this is what you need to do. And that is basically the core of the design of every American roadway.
And this association, though, this is a kind of a trade association, right? This is about, you know, this is a group of people. Like, who's behind it? Is it all state highway officials that are government employees? Or okay, because some of these standards, you know, they're created by industries that benefit from those standards, and then they get adopted because there was a gap in knowledge that they you know, profitably right. filled.
Well, and I mean, and what happened in this case is that actually a bunch of cities, especially denser, more urban cities, actually looked at the Green Book and said, we don't think this is a good set of standards. And you ended up with a different association called NACTA, which is the National Association of City Transportation Officials, which published a different set of standards that has a lot in common. It's still dealing with the same kinds of vehicles, but basically embodies a very different kind of worldview. And so it is fascinating where these standards come from. One of the things we try to do in the book is really point to, like, this is where these numbers are coming from. And I think one of the really important realizations is every one of those numbers comes out of some committee of human beings who sat around a table and decided what those numbers would be. And there's always judgment in that, along with all of the geometry we're talking about. And that's kind of, that's a fascinating piece of the discussion as well.
So when you're going through a city, maybe one other than your own where you're used to working, can you tell like the moment when you've passed from Ashto to, what was the other jurisdiction?
NACTO.
From Ashto to NACTO, it's like, oh, I'm on a NACTO street now, baby. I just had to hit the brakes.
You can kind of, it's actually often also a city versus city difference. It's like, you know, this is a city which has adopted a new set of street standards, and this is a city which hasn't. Or this is a street in a city that was built after they adopted a new set of standards, and here's the street one block over that was clearly built before they adopted those standards. So it can actually be quite unmistakable.
You know, being an architecture and urbanist enthusiast and follower and podcaster, of course, I've talked to numerous people from the fairy lands of, you know, Copenhagen and Amsterdam. And, you know, there are all these techniques that have been introduced to support bike infrastructure on the one hand, and also to make streets safer and slower, like the Woonerf concept, where basically you're not necessarily putting in speed bumps, but you're narrowing the street strategically at certain points. And you do get into that a little bit. In this book, you know, to the extent that it is practiced in the States, have you seen an infusion of these types of, you know, concepts finding their way into these canonical manuals, or is it very piecemeal? Like, how far along do you think on the maturity curve are we in the States and perhaps, you know, Canada and other countries that have similar vehicle sizes? How far along have they gotten in adopting some of these concepts like the Wooner for the road diet, for example?
Yeah, I would say when we think about the Wooner, places where this gets listened to and seen as an opportunity to be safer are places like universities. We are seeing that there's a lot more appetite for these kind of spaces where, you know, we're all going to share this space and we're going to change the material and we're going to make everything one elevation because we want to be inclusive and we want cars to go slower, but we also want to promote bicycling and scooters and walking. And so I'm seeing it a lot in places like that. Designed for that, be welcome there, not with a ton of signage, but really with the design of the features in that space. Christoph, David, you want to weigh in?
I don't know much on the national end or even at the state end, but we have worked on a project, the Dallas Street Design Manual, where we included Woonerfs in one of the street typologies, and we gave guidance on, you know, how to design a successful Woonerf. Whether after we did that, Dallas did anything with it, I'm not sure. I don't go to Dallas because I'm from Houston, and why would I ever need to go to Dallas? but you know, there is an instance where we worked with a city and we introduced that typology in their manual. But Christoph, I don't know. Do you know if they've ever created a Woonerf after we
No, I mean, I think the manuals is actually, I think, an important part of the answer here, because, like, the way I would put it is, you show me the best street in a place like Copenhagen or Amsterdam, and I could show you an equally good street in the United States. The difference isn't what our best designed streets look like compared to their best ones. It's what the average one looks like. And I think what a place like Copenhagen has achieved is they've managed to make the average street really good for bikes. And that the only way you do that is by standardizing and institutionalizing how you design things. Because if in order to have a good bike facility, it takes your best planner and your best engineer to be on the project, you're not going to have a lot of good bike facilities. You need to find a way that these just routinely get pumped out on street after street after street, which is exactly what the Green Book did for freeways. Like, basically, it allowed basically any reasonably competent civil engineer to design a standard U.S. freeway. And just like any reasonably competent engineer can design a standard U.S. suburban street. And I think what we haven't gotten to in the United States is a place where your average engineer can design a great urban street, because we simply have not standardized how urban streets ought to work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, certainly, no, even I think the most lay people would understand if you said this road is engineered to highway standards, they would have a pretty good idea of what that meant, you know. But if you were looking at what was a, you know, a standard urban street, that would be difficult to picture, because they are so different, and the widths are so different, and there is no, it doesn't seem like there's much in the way of standard implementation of bike lanes, even across a given street in one city. I mean, I'm you know, not one of these sort of adamant urban bikers, but I do bike on the Chicago city streets, and it can vary very quite a lot from block to block. You'll be switching, and in that transition, of course, is where it becomes most dangerous, because you come into conflict with parallel traffic, both pedestrian and motor, that's not expecting you. So it's in those transitions where it seems like it's most critical to illustrate that that's happening. And, you know, in the book, there are a few examples of how, you know, intersections can be engineered. And in the time since I've read that book, I've gone on several bike rides and crossed a number of intersections, and I've been like, aha, yes, indeed. And I learned a couple terms of trade, you know, for the names of the little dollops of concrete that separate, you know, people from cars and bikes. So that's been really fun for me. Bike lanes are so political. Can we talk a little bit about why they're so contentious? It seems like everyone likes riding bikes, you know, it's like, but it seems to be this sort of totem of the onslaught of the nanny state, or this kind of, you know, liberal socialist conspiracy in the minds of some people. And I can't fathom why it's so controversial, but it drives people nuts in certain areas.
Yeah, I was going to say, you pointed to intersections and how thoughtful we should be in making that safer, because they bring you to, you know, they bring bike riders to a moment where they're, you know, mixing up with other modes of transportation. I'd also say you also pointed to another thing on your previous point, which is this inconsistency of design. And I think that also confuses users. So while it's not as dangerous, I think that confusion, you know, you get in the way of people, you get in the way of other folks along the way. So I think paying some attention to that in cities is very, very important. But to your question around bicycle lanes and why they're so political, I feel like it's more space we have to give up, right? We figured out we need sidewalks for people to arrive to their destinations. Okay, fine. We're making them 5 feet. We're making them, you know, we'll move them from 4 to 5 here in Houston. Fine. But now it's, oh, now you want to get to work on a bike, you want to get to the store on a bike, you want to get to school on a bike. How do we do that? Can you ride with people on the sidewalk? Can you ride with the car? Oh, we think you might need a separate space, and that needs to come from somewhere, right? And so I think it's that. I think it's we have to give up more space, and that space is usually car space.
And I would say in a bigger sense, like part of what we say in the introduction is, you know, every time we design a street, we are making a decision about how we want to use our commonly owned space, that city right-of-way that belongs to all of us together, that is our shared common space. And we are making a decision about what kind of city we want to live in, because what we do in that street shapes everything around it. If you take the street and make it 6 lanes of traffic with narrow sidewalks, or if you make it 2 lanes of traffic with bike lanes and a tram line and trees, those are going to be totally different streets. They are going to lead to totally different neighborhoods. So we are deciding how we use this thing we own together. And we are deciding what kind of city we want to be. That is inherently political. Like, and I actually think it's wrong to pretend transportation isn't political. Like, I actually hate it when something is presented as, well, our traffic projection said that in 2030 we need this, and therefore the only answer is this. No, it's not. Like, that's a judgment about what kind of place you want to be. It's a judgment about what you want to prioritize. And so I would argue streets should be political, because if streets aren't political, we're actually not having the discussions that matter.
That's a really good point. Speaking of other things that get people charged up, both in the media and in politics, you know, we've talked about engineering for the largest possible vehicle, which is something we've more or less collectively decided to do as a country, right? For at least since the post-war era. But now, you know, there's a lot of incursions of smaller unexpected vehicles and vehicles doing things that, you know, assiduously follow the rules. So then the rules have to be very carefully laid down and very carefully marked, or you could have major conflicts. I'm speaking, of course, of autonomous vehicles, both automobiles and the little delivery robots that trundle along now. And take up space on sidewalks in certain cities. And you can go to YouTube and watch all kinds of hilarious videos of people punking these devices or them crashing through bus shelters or doing other things. So I'm wondering if there is emerging guidance on A, autonomous vehicles, which is a huge category, or B, the smaller, you know, delivery type vehicles, indeed, or other forms of micromobility. The other thing that's nefarious in some cities and a big political football is, you know, dockable bikes and scooters, which, you know, people tend to like to abandon on sidewalks, and it creates another sort of urban detritus problem. So I'm wondering if any of those manuals or organizing bodies are, who's dealing with this, right, at the national level, or is it something that cities have to deal with, you know, individually?
I mean, it's a newest chapter in a long history of fitting new technologies into cities, which we basically spent the last 200 years doing. You know, for the longest time, cities were basically pedestrians and just a couple of carts. And then started adding trolley cars, and we started adding cars, and we started adding bikes, and we started adding all of these things. And these are new versions of that. And one of the fun debates we had in the book is actually a chapter name. Do we have a bike chapter? Do we have a micromobility chapter? Because, you know, 10 years ago, that would have been a bike chapter. But now we have a bunch of other vehicles, which when you step back and look at them, are a pretty similar size and a pretty similar speed to a bike and are pretty compatible with a bike. I mean, and some of them are bikes, they're just e-bikes, but, you know, a scooter actually fits into that pretty well. But then there's other things like e-motos, which really don't fit into that. And then we have this whole struggle about defining vehicles and a whole set of sort of legal challenges around that. And autonomous vehicles, I think, are another layer. But at the same time, what's interesting about them is an autonomous vehicle is still a car. And it still has the same space that a car takes up. And the technology doesn't change that part of it. Like, there's still an inescapable geometry there that having a computer drive doesn't take away. And it still has all of the same space challenges. You know, as people imagine cities where everyone moves in an autonomous vehicle, we still have to ask the question, where do they park? How much space do they take on the street? And I've seen the visions of hey, we can do intersections without traffic signals because all the vehicles will talk to each other, which, I mean, first of all, I think we're not that good at adopting standards. Like, we're still allowing horse-drawn carriages on our roadways. So I think a world in which only autonomous vehicles are allowed, like, seems pretty legally far-fetched. I have trouble imagining that legislation passing. But that intersection is also an intersection which has people on bikes. That intersection has people on foot. Like, how does that fit into that picture? And you realize that, in the end, a car that's driven by a computer faces the same basic challenges as a car that's driven by a person. I mean, a chain may change the behavior of how people use that car, but designing a street for it is really quite the same. And I do think one the way we end the book is sort of a bit on new technologies and sort of point out that a lot of the new technologies we talk about actually are probably not nearly as radical as they sound. And are probably not nearly as big a change as they sound.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of the parking and storage and deployment, you know, I think a lot of people are very tempted to say, well, you know, having autonomous vehicles is going to solve all these traffic problems that we have, and we'll be able to make smaller streets because the cars will efficiently slot themselves in, and we won't have to have all this extra space, you know, to account for human error or the amount of time it takes to react to a red light or an obstruction in the road. Of course, we've seen in the early outings of many autonomous vehicles that sometimes their reaction time is nil and they don't recognize people as people on the street, especially when it's dark or they're in unexpected places. So we've got a long way to go with respect to that. But even just, you know, putting aside the question of like operation, you know, in the traffic way, I mean, do you see parking requirements going down on account of autonomous vehicles being introduced anytime soon? Parking minimums? I know some cities are relaxing parking minimums and in some cases employing maximums in areas where there is adequate transit to pick up the slack. But when should we expect to see the great parking reduction as a result of autonomous vehicles? Will I still be alive? I mean,
I don't know. I think this comes back to the same issues that we face today. You know, we look at different uses along a corridor and, you know, you have office buildings near restaurants and we wonder why can't we do shared parking around here? Office has its hours and a restaurant or a bar has its busy times and we can't seem to get on the same page in terms of how we deal with it. So I think we're facing very similar challenges there. You know, parking is required of the business owners and private property a lot of times. Now, in parking districts, maybe. I think we'll get better at that. But when it comes down to property owners talking to each other and deciding on that, that's still ultimately, you know, the same things we're facing with today. I hope we get better at that.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there are some efficiencies to be found. Like, if your car is able to drive to the nearest open parking space, maybe we can more efficiently manage our spaces. You know, one of the things about parking is the lack of sharing means that you look at a downtown, every building has its own parking garage just for the people who are using that particular building, and different buildings have different demands at different times. And like, we often have quite a remarkable number of empty parking spaces, which are incredibly expensive to build. But some of that could be achieved without autonomous vehicles simply by having better management and better wayfinding and like having all the garages be available to everyone and steering everyone to the nearest one. And then there's also interesting exercises, you know. What if it is cheaper to tell your autonomous vehicle to circle the block for 4 hours than to pay for a parking space for it? And what does that do to the level of traffic in our cities? And you realize that there's a whole level of policy that sometimes we very much take for granted that also shapes all of this.
Right. I mean, you could give an autonomous vehicle instructions that are very self-interested for the preservation of that vehicle, but you could also give it, and by preservation, I guess I mean, well, like the example you cited, where it's cheaper to you know, if you say, set a rule where, like, don't pay for parking, it's like, okay, well, I guess I'll just circulate then. You know, if there is an overlay of technology that would say to that automobile, well, you know, during the hours of, you know, 9 to 5 in this central business district, don't do that because you're going to create a massive traffic situation that otherwise wouldn't be there. But there has to be that overlay, right? So then you're asking for the technology to be synced up with individual owner preference or priorities plus whatever the municipality or governing authority has. And that all has to be baked into software somehow.
No, and it's interesting, in the book we talk about other moments like that. You know, there was a really interesting moment when cars came along and the question was, how do we make cars work in cities? And some of that answer was physical. It was reconstruction of streets. It was building of freeways and so forth. But some of it was policy. It was inventing the idea of jaywalking as a way to ensure that pedestrians would cross streets only in carefully controlled places. Like, that was a layer of policy that we now totally take for granted that was added on top of a city to make this new mode of transportation function. And we will keep needing to do that as well in order to make all of this work.
Well, it sounds like you will all be in work for the foreseeable future, because this stuff keeps changing, and it seems like it's changing faster now. In as much as, yeah, it's true, people do seem to still favor these, you know, enormous vehicles for their personal, you know, vehicles. I think the F-150 is still like the most popular vehicle on the road. We've seen in past swings that you know, oil prices can change that. There's a greater prevalence of EVs, of course, and then, of course, the autonomous vehicles. That's just what's on the road. And then you have, you know, the fact that there's an emerging thought about, well, maybe we should design cities for people again. And I guess the question is, what's next? What would the next practical framework or guidebook have in it that you weren't able to get into this edition? Flying cars, we haven't talked about that yet.
That's a really fun question.
Yeah, y'all teach airplanes and boats at some point in your class, don't you?
I mean, that's true. I mean, one of the things I actually love, it's funny because a bunch of the stuff in the book and stuff that we teach is stuff we actually work on. Like, I work on streets, I work on transit systems, I work on bike lanes. But something I've never worked on and probably never will that I find really fascinating is airports. Because airports are a different kind of geometry problem. And to me, there's like two really interesting pieces of airport geometry that are very unique. The first is the scale, that you have to design one building that works for the scale of an airplane on one side of the building, the scale of a pedestrian in the middle, and the scale of the car on the other side. And we all know what it feels like when you don't resolve that well, when you find, like, why in the world am I walking so far to my gate? That means the pedestrian scale and the airplane scale haven't been reconciled very well. Or why in the world is this curb so chaotic, and why am I waiting 20 minutes to get picked up by someone who's stuck in a traffic jam? That means we haven't reconciled the scale of the car to the scale of the pedestrian very well. And it's interesting throughout the history of airport design how many different takes there have been on that. And also that a bunch of those takes turned out to be outmoded. Like, there was a set of airports that were designed with the goal of getting the car as close to the airplane as possible. In Houston, they stacked the garage on top of the terminal. In Dallas, they did these crescent-shaped terminals with the garage in the middle. But those were invented before the rash of hijackings, which led to security checkpoints. And as soon as you invent security checkpoints, suddenly that getting the car close to the plane like doesn't work in the same way. And then you invent hub airports and it totally doesn't work. And that security is also the other really interesting layer, that every airport is at least two different secure zones, really three counting the tarmac, that you have to very carefully separate, and even the design of that. So airports are actually a really fascinating transportation problem that I think are very much underappreciated as a design challenge.
I think we're going to see a book out on that pretty soon. You probably know Tom Vanderbilt, who wrote Traffic. He is working on an airports book, and we have him scheduled somewhere down the line when that gets ready to be released. That'll be a fascinating conversation.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the biggest question is, you know, it's great to have something like this in front of us that really lays out things. It's pretty even-handed. You know, really, you mentioned, you know, at the top of the conversation, you know, how these conversations can be so politicized. But I do wonder if we need to have stronger advocacy for one type of, not necessarily one approach, but a philosophy to that approach where engineering for vehicles is not the priority that rules all space. Traffic engineers are the ones who get blamed for a lot of this stuff. So I'm talking to the people in the room. What do you think? I mean, do we need to think about cities in a different way? And if we did, how would you envision your practice or your pedagogy changing?
I mean, I think one thing we tried to do with this book is basically say these are the basic technical facts of each of these modes. Like, saying cars take a lot of space is not an opinion. It is not advocacy. It is a plain fact. We can map it out for you how much space they take. And then you can make a decision about what kind of city you want to have. And what we're saying is, if you make a city where you say the only way to get around is by car, which the decision you're making is that you're going to have more than half of the area of that city be streets and parking lots. The decision you're making is that your destinations are going to be further apart. The decision you're making is that walking and biking are going to be only very, very, a very limited utility. And the decision you're making is you're not going to have high ridership transit. Like, those are decisions you are making. And I don't think the book is telling you that's a wrong decision. It's just saying if you make that decision, these are the implications of it. And to really take all the modes seriously that way, we're making decisions and this is what those decisions mean. So I think that was very intentional. And I think we can take any of these modes and we can respect it for what it's good at. You know, like I do think, in the urbanist world, people sometimes tend to forget what cars are quite good at. And the rural Great Plains are a way better place with cars than they were with any other form of transportation. You know, you map out what it took to travel by train in those very sparse places, and like, it was not very efficient. It was not very useful. And the car absolutely revolutionized what it was there for. Each of these modes of transportation has things they're very good at. And I don't want to undersell that either. This is not an advocacy book. This is not a manifesto. And I think there are some very good manifestos out there. I've read a lot of them. I have liked a lot of them. But I think this book very intentionally is not that. Because we think that there's these basic things you have to understand to work in transportation. And just understanding them can help you make your own decisions about what you want to do.
Yeah, this is really great. It's almost like a version of the big red book that Wiley used to produce for architects, the graphic design standards that was like this, you know, 7 inches thick, and it was the required to be on everyone's desk back in the day. This is a much more compact version of that, but it is absolutely packed with information that I think anyone who's remotely interested in why cities look like they do, you know, particularly in this part of the world, would have an interest in this book. So it definitely kept me going. I want to thank you guys for putting this together and for spending the time with me. You know, I think I'll just take a moment to say I love that this is coming out of Houston. You know, I think it's a city that people in, you know, urban planning circles like to criticize, and I think that's a little unfair. It grew when it grew. There's lots to be said about it in terms of, you know, it's very high ethnic diversity and a really interesting cultural background, great food, all this great stuff. But yeah, it has a little bit to answer for in terms of how much concrete you've laid down. But I mean, it's great that that what may be the definitive book on how transportation shapes cities comes from the city where there's some of the most heavy engineering of traffic infrastructure on Earth has taken place. And, you know, you still have a really fun, workable city. So it is possible to have that, you know, within that context, but to know that all this is possible is really quite interesting. So thank you all for your time.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think one of the things the way I see Houston is we have a lot of opportunity because we have a lot of space. And I think that's where Houston can shine, is our right-of-ways are wide. And we can, by prioritizing, we can build, rebuild, redesign a city to be useful to other modes as well and be safe for other modes as well.
That's a really good point, actually. I mean, by overcompensating by default, it's not, you can then shrink back down, right? Or fill with other modes. That's a good point. It was something I was going to raise earlier too about, you know, you see these debates about, well, should we do rails to trails or should we do transit in this corridor that might be, you know, wide and have like power lines next to it? It's like, well, why can't you do both?
Yes.
But I mean, where would you start in that discussion? You would be looking in a book like this with the existing standards of this is how much space it takes to make that work. So, I mean, I would think, yeah, it would be a great, Houston would be a great proving ground for that type of discussion.
Yeah. No, and the other thing I just love about Houston is it's been a city that is open to change. And that's really cool because if we want better transit networks, if we want better bike networks, if we want better pedestrian networks, like we have to be willing to change things. And I feel like in a lot of cities, that is actually the biggest hurdle. There is just this absolute resistance to change. And even some of our cities, which are actually some of our most walkable cities, some of the cities where biking could be the most useful, are also the cities where it takes 10 years of talking to redesign a single street. And what I love about Houston is there is actually a willingness to be ambitious and a willingness to do things differently. And that's a really wonderful thing because I think cities need that. Cities change. And we need to be able to change transportation networks as cities change around them.
Indeed. Well, thanks again, everybody. This has been very enjoyable. This is Transportation in the Shape of Cities with Christoph Spieler, David Copeland Laredo, and Mandy Chapa.
Rogers, a roast beef sandwich! Thomas Edison! Grover Cleveland! John Fenwick! Joyce Kilmer!